Welcome to the Athenaeum. For those of you who haven't been here before in particular, it's a delight to have so many folks here, both our members and their guests and others, who are interested in tonight's speaker and the book about which she will talk. Jennifer Egan, whom the University of Pennsylvania proudly numbers among its graduates, is the author of Go Penn, is the author of several novels and short story collections. Her new novel, Manhattan Beach, published last fall, has been awarded the 2018 Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction. Her last novel, as everybody in this room knows, A Visit from the Goon Squad, won the 2011 Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Also a journalist, she has written frequently in the New York Times Magazine and other publications. National Public Radio critic Maureen Corrigan, also just by the way a Penn alum, had this to say about Manhattan Beach, quote, "It is a big, gorgeous tribute to New York City and its seaport. In drawing from the classic catalog of New York stories, Manhattan Beach also takes its place among them," end quote. Jennifer Egan was recently named president of PEN, Penn America, taking leadership of an organization that has a combined membership of 7,000 writers, journalists, screen and script writers, translators, and editors. PEN, Penn's job, is to mobilize against dangers that challenge free expression in the United States and worldwide. There has not been a time in our nation's post-war history when the work that Penn does has been more important. Join me in welcoming Jennifer Egan.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here. I managed to spend four wonderful years in Philadelphia without ever entering this amazing structure. But I'm happy to see a little different slice of Philadelphia than I was familiar with as a student, and also to have my dear friend from college with me, Eva, whom I met right on the first day at Penn, and we've remained incredibly close ever since. So thank you all for being here. I thought what I would do is talk a little bit about how I came to write this book and use some visuals, which I haven't traditionally done at readings, but somehow there were so many fun adventures that resulted from researching Manhattan Beach that I have found myself wanting to share those. So I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to read a little bit of the first chapter, and then I'm more than happy to also answer your questions. So I do not start a book with characters or plot. I really just begin with a time and a place, or sort of a notion of a time and a place. And in the case of Manhattan Beach, that was New York during World War II, and I started thinking about it in the early years of the 21st century. And I think really what prompted that probably was 9/11. I lived in New York then, as I do now, and I was stunned by how overnight the city became a war zone and remained so for months. And it led me to wonder what it was like to live in New York during the war and to feel that threat of a sea or an air invasion. And I was also interested in the trajectory of American global power, which 9/11 led many people to reflect on. And I was interested in what it felt like to be in New York when that power was amassing during the war. So I began at the New York Public Library by just looking at a lot of images of New York during the war. And this particular book, sorry, the title's a little cut off, New York in the 40s by Andreas Feininger, was incredibly important. And you can see right from the cover something that I noticed as soon as I began looking generally at images of New York during the war, which is that water seemed to be present in almost all of them. It was really as if the heat and the center of the city was at its edges rather than in the middle. And that was very surprising to me. I had lived in New York since 1987, taken a few rides on the Circle Line, enjoyed running along the rivers, but I had given, I think it's safe to say, 0.00 thought to the Port of New York. But of course, the Port of New York is the reason New York exists. And so I began thinking about that, and my attention fixed on the water. This is another image from that book, the Hammerhead Crane, which was an absolutely massive apparatus at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. If you look carefully at that, at the scale, I think you'll see that it is quite a large thing. I mean, that's a ship on the lower right of it. And so I thought, the Brooklyn Navy Yard, gee, that's a familiar phrase. I said, I think that's actually kind of near where I live. And indeed, it was about 7 blocks away. A 225-acre industrial park, formerly a naval yard for more than a century, that I had never set foot in. It was actually, was and is, closed to the public. So I took a tour. Here's another picture of the hammerhead crane. You can see it in the distance. So it really was enormous. So I took a tour of the Navy Yard in 2005. And as you can see, this image was taken in 2005. That's the old railroad transom that was used to float cars into the yard. In 2005, this thing had not been touched in a very long time. There it is again. There was a lot of the war left at the Navy Yard in 2005. This is the captain of the yard's office in Building 77. The roof was caving in, the ice and snow were pouring in, and there were old World War II maps on the walls in 2005. So it will tell you something about the way in which the yard is still changing, that this building recently reopened with windows now covering the entire building and a food court in the bottom floor. So things have continued to evolve at the Navy Yard. But I felt so excited by my experience of touring it with the archivist, and it was a particular sort of excitement that I've learned to pay very close attention to, because I don't write about my own life or about people I know, much to the joy of my friends and family. And I have to pay attention to the moments when things I encounter in the outside world feel like portals into something interesting, and I felt that about the Navy Yard. So I began trying to research it in every way I could, and very shortly I found myself at the Brooklyn Historical Society, which was right near my younger son's preschool, where he went for about 2 hours, 3 times a week. It was such a short amount of time, I couldn't even go home. So I started going to the Brooklyn Historical Society, where there was an amazing collection of material relating to the Navy Yard, one of which was a collection of letters. And I'm going to try to remember how to do the pointer. How do I do the point? Oops, that didn't work. How do I do that? Sorry.
If this fails you, then you know you.
Well, I just want to use the little laser.
Oh.
Sorry.
Bruce will show you how.
Okay. Bruce told me. This is not Bruce's fault. Oh, great. Okay. So, this is Lucille Colkin. She and her husband, Al Colkin, met at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. He was a machinist, and she was a ship fitter. There she is with a bunch of her friends. And Lucy and Al fell madly in love. It was a shipyard romance. They married quickly. In fact, in one of her letters, she referred to it as from maidenhood to marriage in 3 easy months. And then Al joined the Navy, so he went to boot camp, and Lucy wrote to him on a daily basis. And there she called him Butch, dear Butch. And she wrote these absolutely adoring letters. And often she was on the streetcar, which would, her handwriting would get a little wonky as it would bump over the tracks. And she was the kind of person, you're just so thrilled that her letters survive, because they were full of local color, they were full of gossip. She talked about race, she talked about labor relations. She talked a lot about her work, since Al understood it, because they had met at the Navy Yard. Brooklyn Historical Society also has all of her notebooks that she took in ship fitting class. So you can see her, she has a very careful midship section with all of the decks. And one thing that was so winning was that sometimes in these notebooks, there would be a list that said things like, get pants fixed. Buy shoes, return notebook. And it was so much like being inside her mind that I began to feel like I was meeting up with a friend when my son was at preschool. Now, to give you an idea of how long ago this was, he is now taller than I am and has a deep voice. He was still in diapers. So there was one letter that Lucy wrote to Al that was very powerful. She had had a dream that they had had a son, and he was changing the boy's diaper. And she said, "Ah, Butch, what will our lives be like? Where will we live? You know, how many children will we have? What's going to happen to us?" And I thought, yeah, I wonder what will happen to them. And then I glanced at the date of the letter and recalled that it was 1944. So, in fact, there were answers to these questions. So I did what we all do when we have a question that needs an answer. I walked to the nearest computer terminal and typed in Lucille Culkin, and within 60 seconds of reading her fantasies about her future in her handwriting, I was reading a newspaper obituary of Lucy. And it was really one of those jarring shocks that is possible in our technological moment where we can know such opposing things. I learned that she had had two daughters, that they had lived in Brooklyn. Al had survived her. She had passed away just a few years before. And I went back to the letters, and at first I found them hard to read. I felt like I knew too much, and it was painful to perceive her innocence about her own future when I knew not only some of the things that would happen in her life, but actually when it would end. But ultimately, I was lulled back into Lucy's land, and in fact, very sad when she went to join Al in California, and of course, the letters ended. So I wrote an essay called Reading Lucy, which was about the feeling of forming a friendship with someone whom I had never physically met, and in fact, who had never been alive in the time that I was aware of her existence. And I published it in a book of essays by several different writers about Brooklyn. And about 2 months later, I received an email on my public email address, and the subject line was, "I am Lucy's daughter." An amazing moment. So Lucy's daughter, Judy, who was still a librarian then and now is retired, had this essay had found its way to her, and she and Lucy's other daughter, Marge, were all excited. I mean, I had been reading their mother's letters. So we arranged a field trip to the Brooklyn Navy Yard in 2008. So we've got Lucy's two daughters who are there. That's Judy and that's Marge. That is Al, who was in his 80s with his walker. And this woman is named Ida, who worked with Lucy at the Navy Yard. In fact, she is in that picture, which we'll come back to in a minute. So this was an amazing experience. Now, I could hardly look at Al. I knew way too much about Al. And as I looked at this very respectable and reserved gentleman, lines would float through my mind like, just a few more little kisses and an incy-wincy pinch on the aft end. And Al kept his distance from me. He knew what was in those letters. So the two of us were at a bit of a standoff, but it was a very moving day. There is Al in Building 128, the machine shop where he worked, which was untouched since the war, except that the machinery had been removed. There he is alone, and you can see it's an old World War II sign over his head. So it was pretty amazing to be there with all of them. And again, just to give you some perspective on how the Navy Yard keeps changing, look carefully at that building. There you go. They took everything off the skeleton and rebuilt a building around it, and it now, as you can see, is a very sleek, I'm not sure what it even is. So here we are back to Lucy and her friends, and that woman, that gray-haired woman, is Ida right there, who was a welder during the war and who talked with such eloquence about how much she loved to weld. Now, the reason we were having these conversations, because through this experience and others in which we reached out to try to find people, women especially, who had worked at the Navy Yard during the war, the Brooklyn Historical Society, the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and I began an oral history project, a collaboration of us three entities. And our goal was to interview everyone we could find who had worked at the Navy Yard at any time. And I was especially interested in people who had worked there during the war, and especially the women. Of the 70,000 employees at the Navy Yard, which, by the way, was the largest builder and repairer of Allied ships in the world during World War II. Very competitive with Philadelphia, though. It's funny, when you read the newsletter, as I did in great quantities, from the Navy Yard, there was a constant tension over who was selling more war bonds, Philadelphia or Brooklyn. But anyway, of those 70,000 employees at the height of the war, almost 5,000 were women. And of course, this is a narrative many of us know, which is that women were urged to take on responsibilities and industrial jobs that they had been told all their lives they could not do during the war. And Ida made that narrative very real to me when we did our oral history interview with her, because she achieved a lot of seniority as a welder. At the beginning of the war, and in fact for the first couple of years that women worked there, they were not allowed on ships. There was a feeling that men would not be able to control themselves in the workplace. Now, as we know, that is never a problem anymore. But at that time, there was a fear that this might happen. So women were kept off the ships. They did not like that. It was a shipyard. And ultimately, it behooved the Navy Yard to get the women onto the ships because they were much more physically adept at maneuvering in these tight spaces. Ida was barely 5 feet tall and very slender and limber. So she was basically just a top-notch welder, achieved seniority, had a lot of respect. When the women were all fired from the Navy Yard, which happened before the war even ended, Ida, who was working class, as many of the women were who worked there, thought, well, I'm sure not going to back to the phone company. I am a welder now. And she tried for the rest of her life, on and off, to get jobs as a welder. And every time, she was not only turned down, but laughed at and treated with contempt. And this was happening 6 months after she had worked as a senior welder in a Navy Yard. So it was it made very palpable for me that story about women being given opportunities, urged to take them, and then denied them, and in a certain sense, asked to forget that it had ever happened. Another person we interviewed for our oral history is this gentleman in the middle, Don Condrell. He grew up next to the Brooklyn Navy Yard. He never worked there. There he is in his short pants, 1930-something. He lived on Sand Street, which was a kind of famous thoroughfare right outside the Navy Yard where all the action happened. The sailors went there, the tattoo parlors, a million uniform shops. And none of it exists anymore. It was all raised to build a housing project. So Don Condrell and his memory, you can see he gave us all kinds of photos from the time, which he annotated in various ways. He even included things, here you can see these are the old wood structures. I mean, this stuff is so far gone. He included little things like, this little note says, this became the home of the Bloody Bucket Bar. He also said, like, that's where one prostitute stood, and that's where the other prostitute stood. So he knew everything, and he drew us a map of the area. This is only a section of it. It's amazing. Like, that little street, Fern Street, I have no idea where that even was. This has all been completely razed, but he had such marvelous details of the neighborhood, including the fact that there were two bars. One was called the Oval Bar and the other the Square Bar, owned by brothers who were rivalrous and in competition with each other. And apparently, Army guys went to one and Navy guys went to the other, and there were big fights when they would overlap. Another area of interest and that excitement that I described earlier also arose from the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which was deep sea diving. Unbeknownst to me, deep sea diving was an important part of ship repair, and this is a reminiscence by a gentleman who was a civilian diver at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. That was something I hadn't known about. But I, again, had that feeling looking at him in that suit, and if he had the headpiece on, you would recognize it as the iconic diving apparatus I think any of us would imagine. the Mark V with the big spherical helmet, which was in fact current from the beginning of the 20th century into the 1960s. So I have never scuba dived, but I became fixated on this sort of diving. And I got involved with a group of Army divers, veterans, who invited me to a reunion, which they have every other year. And at the reunion, one thing that they do, you can see that's a diving tank at the bottom, they allow any of their attendees who wish to be dressed in the old Mark V and dive in that tank. Now, the only ones I saw who actually took anyone up on this were young guys like the ones you see in the picture, who I think were just interested in using the old equipment. But I had the chance with my two diving mentors who were in the picture with me, Frenchie LaVille on the left and Jim Heimbach on the right, to get dressed in the 200-pound diving suit. There we are. And now that was the extremely brief moment during which I stood, because it probably won't surprise you to hear that wearing a 200-pound diving suit is absolutely agonizingly uncomfortable. That's really putting it mildly. Also at the same reunion, I interviewed this gentleman, Jim Kennedy, a World War II diver who dove in the harbor of Cherbourg and described removing all the detritus that the Germans exploded there to try to keep the Allies from using the harbor. And out of all of that came the opportunity to interview this woman, Andrea Crabtree, the first female Army diver. She did not dive until the 1980s, and women did not dive in the Navy until the 70s. Women are still pretty underrepresented in the world of diving. Andrea was like a guardian angel to this project. She spent hours and hours on the phone with me. And interestingly, although she is a wonderfully optimistic and upbeat person, she was essentially driven out of diving by sexism. It was very difficult to integrate with the men, and they essentially didn't want her there. So that was, all of those were obstacles to what I had a vague sense that I wanted to make happen in this book, which was to actually have a woman become a civilian diver. But all of these were sort of vague thoughts between 2005 and 2010 as I conducted many of these interviews with individuals who were in their 80s, sometimes their late 80s then, and it was important to get these stories down while we could. As one example, Jim Kennedy told me that he had met a female Russian diver in Cherbourg, the only female diver he met during the war. I felt like there was a little more to the story. That maybe he wasn't telling me as I sat there with all of his army chums. And so we had a plan to speak on the phone in the next couple of months, and I would get more details. And as you can see, he's in perfect health there. He very suddenly passed away, and we were never able to have that conversation. So it was just an example of how important it was to make these talks happen right away. Another realm that the water led me to was that of crime. The waterfront was unbelievably dirty. That sort of criminal and pilfering and exploitative milieu was immortalized in the movie On the Waterfront, which was derived from a series of newspaper exposés of the corruption on the Irish waterfront on the west side of Manhattan. I love crime as long as I'm not the victim of it, and especially if it's imaginary. And that may have something to do with this gentleman, my grandpa, Edward Egan. He was a police detective and ultimately a commander on the south side of Chicago. And you may recognize the gentleman in front to the left, President Truman. My grandfather became one of his bodyguards when Truman was still a senator, and what a fop my grandfather was. Look at him. He's the only one in a white suit. But he and Truman got along really well, and after Truman became president, my grandfather continued to be one of his bodyguards when he visited. There's my grandfather. I mean, I included this for the fashion alone. I mean, look at these guys. It's straight out of a noir movie. And they had a great time together. My grandfather's on the left. There are stories of them ducking out of official events and just going and having a great time. My grandfather's partner is on the other side. And By the time I knew my grandfather, he was a jolly, white-haired guy who couldn't have been sweeter, but apparently he was actually rather stern and you know, pretty severe cop. And there was a funny story my uncle tells of my grandfather sort of looking with narrowed eyes at the street one day as they stood together, and my uncle said, "What are you doing, Dad?" And he said, "Just trying to separate the good guys from the bad guys." So that's the family I come from on one side. Here are my grandparents with my father, and I mean, can you believe the fedora? I mean, boy. So my father, Donald Egan, there he is holding me. He was a very devout Catholic, and he and my mother, he married a Protestant, was not a great idea. And in fact, their marriage was annulled when I was two. So that shows you how much clout my grandfather had in the Chicago church hierarchy. There I am with my father, and after their marriage was annulled, we all still lived in Chicago until I was seven, and I would spend every Sunday with my father, and we would go to church together, and we would talk a lot. And one of the things we talked about was his brother Eddie, who was about a year younger than he was and who had been killed in a sort of freak motorcycle accident at 16. He went out to go around the block during a barbecue with his friend on his friend's motorcycle, and they were hit. And my father's little brother was killed. And it was, as you can imagine, just a catastrophe for their family. But in what I now understand to be sort of stereotypical Irish-American fashion, Eddie was essentially never discussed after the funeral was over. And my father was a wonderful but also a troubled man, had a big drinking problem, as did his younger brother. But during these years, when I still lived in Chicago, because I moved to San Francisco at seven, I have many wonderful memories of my father talking to me about his brother Eddie. For some reason, I guess because I was a kid, it was comfortable to have that conversation with me. And so I think without realizing it, in the course of working on this book, it became a chance for me to learn a little bit more about that sort of Irish-American culture that my father came from, which I ended up knowing very little about, because after I moved to San Francisco, in some ways, I really didn't know my father anymore. I felt that with every year, I got to know him less, and then in a freakish piece of bizarre symmetry, my father, who got sober in his 50s, completely turned his life around, was hit by a truck while bicycling. Okay, remember his brother with the motorcycle? With the Vermont Bicycle Club, and he had just turned 60 and was about to run in his fourth marathon. So I really never got a chance to get to know him. And I think in some ways, while I like to believe that my books have nothing to do with me, in some way, this book was an effort to understand at least the world that he came from. So in 2012, I finally sat down to write. This says 11, but that's because it was right after the new year, and I was still getting the year wrong. And as you can see, I write fiction by hand. And you may also notice that it's somewhat illegible. And the reason that I do that is because even after all those years of research and some really fun adventures, I still had no idea what my book was going to be about. I had a notion about various worlds that interested me, but no characters and no plot. I sit down and I start writing, and my goal is to be surprised by what happens on the page. I wrote a 1,400-page first draft, so it looked like this. Then I type up the 1,400 pages, and I start editing, and I edit by hand. This is probably late in the process because at the beginning, almost every line would be crossed out. There it is again. And you can see, I mean, I end up with symbols and extra pages and twirling writing that goes all the way around the page. And so from beginning to end, it was almost exactly a five-year process. A year and a half writing that 1,400-page first draft, then typing it up, making a very detailed outline, my first outline, in the process of what I think the book could be and how to get it there. And then many, many layers of revision, which I generally do by hand on hard copies. One of the first surprises that happened in this writing process was that I found myself not writing about the Brooklyn Navy Yard at all, but about people arriving at a fancy house on what I later realized had to be Manhattan Beach, which is two beaches down from Coney Island. It was the site in the Gilded Age of hotels like this, which you can see are just amazing. And look at that, the Manhattan Beach Hotel, very exclusive. Ultimately, those were dismantled, and it became a place where people went in the summer. There were bungalows. And then during World War II, it was the site of a Coast Guard training center and a Merchant Marine training center. So I'm going to just read you a teeny bit of that first chapter, which takes place at Manhattan Beach, and in which, in fact, really the three major characters of the book are introduced. How do I make that light? Oh, well, it doesn't matter. Okay, the first section is called The Shore. They'd driven all the way to Mr. Stiles's house before Anna realized that her father was nervous. First, the ride had distracted her, sailing along Ocean Parkway as if they were headed for Coney Island, although it was 4 days past Christmas and impossibly cold for the beach. Then the house itself, a palace of golden brick, three stories high, windows all the way around, a rowdy flapping of green and yellow striped awnings. It was the last house on the street, which dead-ended at the sea. Her father eased the Model J against the curb and turned off the motor. "Toots," he said, "don't squint at Mr. Stiles's house." "Of course I won't squint at his house." "You're doing it now." "No," she said, "I'm making my eyes narrow." "That's squinting," he said. "You've just defined it." "Not for me." He turned to her sharply. "Don't squint." That was when she knew. She heard him swallow dryly and felt a chirp of worry in her stomach. She was not used to seeing her father nervous. Distracted, yes. Preoccupied, certainly. "Why doesn't Mr. Stiles like squinting?" she asked. "No one does." "You never told me that before." "Would you like to go home?" "No, thank you." "I can take you home. If I squint?" "If you give me the headache I'm starting to get." "If you take me home," Anna said, "you'll be awfully late." She thought he might slap her. He'd done it once after she'd let fly a string of curses she'd heard on the docks, his hand finding her cheek invisibly as a whip. The specter of that slap still haunted Anna, with the odd effect of heightening her boldness in defiance of it. Her father rubbed the middle of his forehead, then looked back at her. His nerves were gone. She had cured them. "Anna," he said, "you know what I need you to do." "Of course." "Be your charming self with Mr. Stiles's children while I speak with Mr. Stiles." "I knew that, Papa." "Of course you did." She left the Model J with eyes wide and watering in the sun. It had been their own automobile until after the stock market crash. Now it belonged to the union, which lent it back for her father to do union business. Anna liked to go with him when she wasn't at school, to racetracks, communion breakfasts, and church events, office buildings where elevators lofted them to high floors, occasionally even a restaurant, but never before to a private home like this. Mr. Stiles's daughter, Tabitha, was only 8, 3 years younger than Anna. Still, Anna allowed the littler girl to tow her by the hand to a downstairs nursery, a room dedicated purely to playing, filled with a shocking array of toys. A quick survey discovered a flossy flirt doll, several large teddy bears, and a rocking horse. There was a nurse in the nursery, a freckled, raspy-voiced woman whose woolen dress strained like an overstacked bookshelf to restrain her massive bust. Anna guessed from the broad lay of her face and the merry switch of her eyes that nurse was Irish and felt a danger of being seen through. She resolved to keep her distance. Two small boys, twins, or at least interchangeable, were struggling to attach electric train tracks, partly to avoid Nurse, who rebuffed the boys' pleas for help. Anna crouched beside the disjointed tracks and proffered her services. Tabitha cradled her new Christmas doll, a Shirley Temple in a fox fur coat. She watched entranced as Anna built her brother's train tracks. "Where do you live?" she asked. "Not far. By the beach? Near it. May I come to your house?" "Of course," Anna said, fastening tracks as fast as the boys handed them to her. A figure eight was nearly complete. "Have you any brothers?" Tabitha asked. "A sister," Anna said. "She's eight, like you, but she's mean because of being so pretty." Tabitha looked alarmed. "How pretty?" "Extremely pretty," Anna said gravely, then added, "She looks like our mother who danced with the Follies." The error of this boast accosted her a moment later. "Never part with a fact unless you've no choice," her father's voice in her ears. After lunch, as a reward for their fine behavior, Nurse allowed them to bundle into coats and hats and bolt from a back door along a path that ran behind Mr. Stiles's house to a private beach. A long arc of snow-dusted sand tilted down to the sea. Anna had been to the docks in winter many times, but never to a beach. Miniature waves shrugged up under skins of ice that crackled when she stomped them. Seagulls screamed and dove in the riotous wind, their bellies stark white. The twins had brought along Buck Rogers ray guns, but the wind turned their shots and death throes into pantomime. Anna watched the sea. There was a feeling she had standing at its edge, an electric mix of attraction and dread. What would be exposed if all of that water should suddenly vanish? A landscape of lost objects, sunken ships, hidden treasure, gold and gems, and the charm bracelet that had fallen from her wrist into a storm drain. Dead bodies, her father always added with a laugh. To him, the ocean was a wasteland. "Your shoes are getting wet," Tabby said through chattering teeth. "Should we take them off?" Anna asked, "to feel the cold?" "I don't want to feel it." "I do." Tabby watched Anna unbuckle the straps of the black patent leather shoes she shared with Zara Klein downstairs. She unrolled her wool stockings and placed her white, bony, long for her age feet in the icy water. Each foot delivered an agony of sensation to her heart, one part of which was a flame of ache that felt unexpectedly pleasant. "What's it like?" Tabby shrieked. "Cold," Anna said. "Awful, awful cold." It took all of her strength to keep from recoiling, and her resistance added to the odd excitement. Glancing toward the house, she saw two men in dark overcoats following the paved path set back from the sand. Holding their hats in the wind, they looked like actors in a silent picture. "Are those our papas?" "Daddy likes to have business talks outdoors," Tabby said, "away from prying ears." Anna felt benevolent compassion toward young Tabitha, excluded from her father's business affairs, when Anna was allowed to listen in whenever she pleased. She heard little of interest. Her father's job was to pass greetings or good wishes between union men and other men who were their friends. These salutations included an envelope, sometimes a package, that he would deliver or receive casually. You wouldn't notice unless you were paying attention. Over the years, he'd talked to Anna a great deal without knowing he was talking, and she had listened without knowing what she heard. She was surprised by the familiar, animated way her father was speaking to Mr. Stiles. Apparently, they were friends, after all that. The men changed course and began crossing the sand toward Anna and Tabby. Anna stepped hurriedly out of the water, but she'd left her shoes too far away to put them back on in time. Mr. Stiles was a broad, imposing man with brilliantined black hair showing under his hat brim. "Say, is this your daughter?" he asked, withstanding Arctic temperatures without so much as a pair of stockings. Anna sensed her father's displeasure. "So it is," he said. "Anna, say good day to Mr. Stiles." "Very pleased to meet you," she said, shaking his hand firmly, as her father had taught her, and taking care not to squint as she peered up at him. Mr. Stiles looked younger than her father, without shadows or creases in his face. She sensed an alertness about him, a humming tension, perceptible even through his billowing overcoat. He seemed to await something to react to or be amused by. Right now, that something was Anna. Mr. Stiles crouched beside her in the sand and looked directly into her face. "Why the bare feet?" he asked. "Don't you feel the cold, or are you showing off?" Anna had no ready answer. It was neither of those, more an instinct to keep Tabby awed and guessing. But even that she couldn't articulate. "Why would I show off?" she said. "I'm nearly 12. "Well, what's it feel like?" She smelled mint and liquor on his breath, even in the wind. It struck her that her father couldn't hear their conversation. "It only hurts at first," she said. "After a while, you can't feel anything." Mr. Stiles grinned as if her reply were a ball he'd taken physical pleasure in catching. "Words to live by," he said, then rose again to his immense height. "She's strong," he remarked to Anna's father. "So she is." Her father avoided her eyes. Mr. Stiles brushed sand from his trousers and turned to go. He'd exhausted that moment and was looking for the next. "They're stronger than we are," Anna heard him say to her father. "Lucky for us, they don't know it." She thought he might turn and look back at her, but he must have forgotten. Thank you.